Even when he tried to tell it, even after the 7 weeks, and he's safe, secure, riveted, warranted, and doubly guaranteed by the 10 years they had added to his sentence for attempted escape, something of the old hysteric, incredulous outrage came back into his face, his voice, his speech. He never did even get on the other boat. He told how he clung to a strake. It was a dirty, unpainted shanty boat with a drunken rake of 10 stovepipe. It had been moving when he struck it, and apparently it had not even changed course, even though the 3 people on it must have been watching him all the while. A second man, barefoot and with matted hair and beard, also at the steering sweep, and then, he did not know how long, a woman leaning in the door in a filthy assortment of men's garments, watching him too with the same cold speculation. Being dragged violently along, trying to state and explain his simple, and to him at least, reasonable desire and need. Telling it, trying to tell it, he could feel again the old unforgettable affronting, like an ague fit, as he watched the abortive tobacco rain steadily and faintly from between his shaking hands, and then the paper itself part with a thin, dry, snapping report. "Burn my clothes," the convict cried. "Burn them? How in hell do you expect to escape in them billboards?" the man with the shotgun said. He, the convict, tried to tell it, tried to explain as he had tried to explain not to the 3 people on the boat alone, but to the entire circumambience, desolate water and forlorn trees and sky, not for justification, because he needed none. And he knew that his heroes, the other convicts, required none of him, but rather as, on the point of exhaustion, he might have picked dreamily and incredulously at a suffocation. He told the man with the gun how he and his partner had been given the boat and told to pick up a man and a woman, how he had lost his partner and failed to find the man. And now all in the world he wanted was something flat to leave the woman on until he could find an officer, a sheriff. He thought of home, the place where he had lived almost since childhood. His friends of years, whose ways he knew, and who knew his ways, the familiar fields where he did work he had learned to do well and to like, the mules with characters he knew and respected, as he knew and respected the characters of certain men. He thought of the barracks at night, the screens against the bugs in summer, and good stoves in winter, and someone to supply the fuel and the food too, the Sunday ball games and the picture shows, things which, with the exception of the ball games, he had never known before. But most of all, his own character. 2 years ago, they had offered to make a trustee of him. He would not longer need to plow nor feed stock. He would only follow those who did with a loaded gun, but he declined. "I reckon I'll stick to plowing," he said, absolutely without humor. "I done already tried to use a gun one time too many." His good name, his responsibility not only toward those who were responsible toward him, but to himself, his own honor in doing of what was asked of him, his pride in being able to do it, no matter what it was. He thought of this and listened to the man with the gun talking about escape, and it seemed to him that hanging there, being dragged violently along, it was here, he said, that he first noticed the goat's beard, the moss, and the trees. Though it could have been there for several days, so far as he knew, it just happened that he first noticed it here, that he would simply burst. "Can't you get it into your head that the last thing I want to do is to run away?" he cried. "You can sit there with that gun and watch me. I give you fair leaf. All I want is to put this woman, and I told you she could come aboard," the man with the gun said in his level voice. "But there ain't no room on no boat of mine for nobody hunting a sheriff in no kind of clothes, let alone a penitentiary suit. When he steps aboard, knock him in the head with the gun barrel," the man at the sweep said. "He's drunk. He ain't coming aboard," the man with the gun said. "He's crazy." Then the woman spoke. She didn't move, leaning in the door in a pair of faded and patched and filthy overalls like the 2 men. "Give them some grub and tell them to get out of here." She moved. She crossed the deck and looked down at the convict's companion with her cold, sullen face. "How much more time have you got?" "It wasn't due till next month," the woman in the boat said. "But I," the woman in overalls turned to the man with the gun. "Give them some grub," she said. But the man with the gun was still looking down at the woman in the boat. "Come on," he said to the convict. "Put her aboard and beat it." "And what'll happen to you," the woman in overalls said, "when you try to turn her over to an officer? When you lay alongside a sheriff and the sheriff asks you who you are?" Still the man with the gun didn't even look at her. He hardly even shifted the gun across his arm as he struck the woman across the face with the back of his other hand, hard. "You son of a bitch," he said. Still the man with the gun did not even look at her. "Well," he said to the convict. "Don't you see I can't?" the convict cried. "Can't you see that?" Now, he said, he gave up. He was doomed. That is, he knew now that he had been doomed from the very start never to get rid of her. Just as the ones who sent him out with the skiff knew that he never would actually give up. when he recognized one of the objects which the woman in overalls was hurling into the skiff to be a can of condensed milk, he believed it to be a presage, gratuitous and irrevocable as a death notice over the telegraph, that he was not even to find a flat stationary surface in time for the child to be born on. So he told how he held the skiff alongside the shanty boat while the first tentative toying of the second wave made up beneath him, while the woman in overalls passed back and forth between the house and rail, flinging the food, the hunk of salt meat, the ragged and filthy quilt, the scorched lumps of cold bread which she poured into the skiff from a heaped dishpan like so much garbage, while he clung to the strake against the mounting pull of the current, the new wave which for the moment he had forgotten because he was still trying to state the incredible simplicity of his desire and need, until the man with the gun, the only one of the three who wore shoes, began to stamp at his hands, he snatching his hands away one at a time to avoid the heavy shoes, then grasping the rail again until the man with the gun kicked at his face. He flinging himself sideways to avoid the shoe and so breaking his hold on the rail, his weight canting the skiff off at a tangent on the increasing current, so that it began to leave the shanty boat behind, and he paddling again now violently, as a man hurries toward the precipice for which he knows at last he is doomed. Looking back at the other boat, the three faces sullen and derisive, and grim and rapidly diminishing across the widening water, and at last, apologetic, suffocating with the intolerable fact, not that he had been refused, but that he had been refused so little, had wanted so little, asked for so little, yet there had been demanded of him in return the one price out of all breath, which they must have known, if he could have paid it, he would not have been where he was, asking what he asked, raising the paddle and shaking it and screaming curses back at them, even after the shotgun flashed and the charge went scuttering past along the water to one side. So he hung there, he said, shaking the paddle and howling, when suddenly he remembered that other wave, the second wall of water full of houses and dead mules building up behind him back in the swamp. So he quit yelling then and went back to paddling. He was not trying to outrun it. He just knew from experience that when it overtook him, he would have to travel in the same direction it was moving in anyway, whether he wanted to or not. And when it did overtake him, he would begin to move too fast to stop, no matter what places he might come to where he could leave the woman, land her in time. Time, that was his itch now, so his only chance was to stay ahead of it as long as he could and hope to reach something before it struck. So he went on driving the skiff with muscles which had been too tired too long. They had quit feeling it, as when a man has had bad luck for so long that he ceases to believe it is even bad, let alone luck. Even when he ate, the scorched lumps the size of baseballs and the weight and durability of cannel coal, even after having lain in the skiff's bilge where the shantyboat woman had thrown them, the iron-like lead-heavy objects which no man would have called bread outside of the crusted and scorched pan in which they had cooked. It was with one hand, begrudging even that from the paddle. He tried to tell that, too, the day while the skiff fled on among the bearded trees, while every now and then small, quiet, tentative, exploratory feelers came up from the way behind and toy for a moment at the skiff, light and curious, then go on with a faint hissing sigh, almost a chuckling sound, the skiff going on, driving on with nothing else but trees and water and solitude. Until after a while it no longer seemed to him that he was trying to put space and distance behind him or shorten space and distance ahead, but that both he and the wave were now hanging suspended, simultaneous and unprogressing in pure time upon a dreamy desolation in which he paddled on, not from any hope even to reach anything at all, but merely to keep intact what a little of distance the length of the skiff provided between himself and the inert and inescapable mass of female meat before him. Then night, and the skiff rushing on, fast, since any speed over anything unknown and invisible is too fast, with nothing before him and behind him, the outrageous idea of volume of moving water toppling forward, its crest frothed and shredded like fangs, and then dawn again, another of those dreamlike alterations, day to dark, then back to day again, with that quality truncated, anachronic, and unreal, as the waxing and waning of lights in a theater scene. The skiff emerging now with the woman no longer supine beneath the shrunken soaked private's coat, but sitting bolt upright, gripping the gunwale with both hands, her eyes closed and her lower lip caught between her teeth, and he driving the splintered board furiously now, glaring at her out of his wild, swollen, sleepless face, and crying, croaking, "Hold on, for God's sake, hold on. I'm trying to," she said, "but hurry, hurry." He told it, the unbelievable, "Hurry, hasten," the man falling from a cliff being told to catch on to something and save himself. Very telling of it emerging shadowy and burlesque, ludicrous, comic and mad, from the ague of unbearable forgetting, was a quality more dreamily furious than any fable behind proscenium lights. He was in a basin now. A basin, the plump convict said. That's what you wash in. All right, the tall one said harshly above his hands. I did. With a supreme effort, he stilled them long enough to release the two bits of cigarette paper and watch them waft in light fluttering indecision to the floor between his feet. Holding his hands motionless even for a moment longer, a basin, a broad, peaceful yellow sea which had abruptly and curiously altered air, giving him, even at that moment, the impression that it was accustomed to water, even if not total submersion. He even remembered the name of it, told to him 2 or 3 weeks later by someone, a chaffalow. Louisiana, the plump convict said, you mean you were clean out of Mississippi? Hellfire. He stared at the tall one. Shucks, he said. That ain't but just across from Vicksburg. They never named any Vicksburg across from where I was, the tall one said. It was Baton Rouge they named it. And now he began to talk about a town, a little neat white portrait town nesting among enormous, very green trees, appearing suddenly in the telling as it probably appeared in actuality, abrupt and airy and mirage-like, and incredibly serene before him behind a scattering of boats moored to a line of freight cars, standing flush to the doors in water. And now he tried to tell that, too, how he stood waist-deep in water for a moment, looking back and down at the skiff in which the woman half lay, her eyes still closed, her knuckles white on the gunwales, and a tiny thread of blood creeping down her chin from her chewed lip, and he looking down at her in a kind of furious desperation. How far will I have to walk, she said. I don't know, I tell you, he cried, but it's land somewhere yonder. It's land, houses. If I try to move, it won't even be borne inside a boat, she said. You'll have to get closer. Yes, he cried, wild, desperate, incredulous. Wait, I'll go and surrender, and then they will have. He didn't finish. Wait to finish. He told that, too. Himself splashing, stumbling, trying to run, sobbing and grasping. Now he saw it. Another loading platform, and standing above the yellow flood, the khaki figures on it before, identical, the same. He said how the intervening days since that first innocent morning telescope vanished, as if they had never been, the two contiguous succeeding instants succeeding simultaneously. Had he transported across no intervening space, but merely turned in his own footsteps, plunging, splashing, his arms raised, croaking harshly, he heard the startled shout. There's one of them, the command, the clash of equipment, the alarm cry. There he goes, there he goes. Yes, he cried, running, plunging. Here I am, here, here, running on into the first scattered volley, stopping among the bullets, waving his arms, shrieking, I want to surrender, I want to surrender. Watching not in terror but in amazement, an absolutely unbearable outrage, as a squatting clump of the khaki figures parted and he saw the machine gun. The blunt, thick muzzle slant and drop and probe toward him, and he's still screaming in his hoarse, crow's voice, I want to surrender. Can't you hear me? Continuing to scream, even as he whirled and plunged, splashing, ducking, went completely under and heard the bullets going thuck, 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 thuck on the water above him. And he's scrabbling still on the bottom, still trying to scream even before he regained his feet, and still all submerged save his plunging, unmistakable buttock, the outraged screaming bubbling from his mouth and about his face, since he merely wanted to surrender. Then he was comparatively screened, out of range, though not for long. That is, he didn't tell how far nor where. There was a moment in which he paused, breathed for a second, before running again. The course back to the skiff opened for the time being, though he could still hear the shouts behind him, and now and then a shot. And he panting, sobbing, a long savage tear in the flesh of one hand, got when and how he did not know. And he wasting precious breath, speaking to no one now any more than the scream of the dying rabbit is addressed to an immortal ear, but rather an indictment of all breath and its folly and suffering, its infinite capacity for folly and pain, which seems to be its only immortality. All in the world I want is just to surrender. He returned to the skiff and got in and took up his splintered plank. And now when he told this, despite the fury of the element which climaxed it, the telling became quite simple. He now even creased another cigarette paper between his fingers, which did not tremble at all, and filled the paper from the tobacco sack without spilling a flake, as though he had passed from the machine gun's barrage into a bourne beyond any more amazement, so that the subsequent part of his narrative seemed to reach his listeners as though from beyond a sheet of slightly milky, though still transparent, glass, as something not heard but seen, a series of shadows, edgeless yet distinct, and smooth the floor, and logical and unfrantic, making no sound. They were in the skiff, in the center of the broad, placid trough which had no boundaries, and down which the tiny, forlorn skiff flew to the irresistible coercion of a current going once more he knew not where.
The neat small live oak bowered towns, unattainable and mirage-like, and apparently attached to nothing upon the airy and unchanging horizon. He did not believe them. They did not matter. He was doomed. They were less than figments of smoke or of delirium. And he was driving his unceasing paddle without destination or even hope now, looking now and then at the woman sitting with her knees drawn up and locked, and her entire body one terrific clench while the threads of bloody saliva crept from her teeth-clenched lower lip. He was going nowhere and fleeing from nothing. He merely continued to paddle because he had paddled so long now that he believed if he stopped, his muscle would scream in agony. So when it happened, he was not surprised. He heard the sound which he knew well. He had heard it but once before, true enough, but no man need hear it but once. And he had been expecting it. He looked back, still driving the paddle, and saw it, curled, crested with its straw-like flotsam of trees and debris and dead beasts. And he glared over his shoulder as for a full minute out of that attenuation far beyond the point of outragement, where even suffering, the capability of being further affronted, had ceased, from which he now contemplated with savage and invulnerable curiosity the further extent to which his now anesthetized nerves could bear, what next could be invented for them to bear, until the wave actually began to rear over his head in its thundering climax. Then only did he turn his head. His stroke did not falter. It neither slowed nor increased. Still paddling with a spent hypnotic steadiness, he saw the swimming deer. He did not know what it was, nor that he had altered the skiff's course to follow it. He just watched the swimming head before him, as the wave boiled down and the skiff rose bodily in the old familiar fashion on a wealth of tossing trees and houses and bridges and fences. He still paddling even while the paddle found no purchase save air, and still paddling even as he and the deer shot forward side by side at arm's length. He watching the deer now, watching the deer begin to rise out of the water bodily until it was actually running along the surface, still rising, soaring clear of the water altogether, vanishing upward in a dying crescendo of splashings and snapping branches, its damp scut flashing upward, the entire animal vanishing upward as smoke vanishes. And now the skiff struck and canted, and he was out of it too, standing knee-deep, springing out and falling to his knees, scrabbing up, glaring after the vanished deer. "Land," he croaked, "land, hold on, just hold on." He caught the woman beneath the arms, dragging her out of the boat, plunging and panting after the vanished deer. Now earth actually appeared, an acclivity smooth and swift and steep, bizarre, solid and unbelievable, an Indian mound. And he plunging at the muddy slope, slipping back, the woman struggling in his muddy hand. "Let me down," she cried, "let me down." But he held her, panting, sobbing, and rushed again at the muddy slope. He had almost reached the third crest with his now violently unmanageable burden when a stick under his foot gathered itself with a thick convulsive speed. It was a snake, he thought, as his feet fled beneath him, and with the indubitable last of his strength he half pushed and half flung the woman up the bank as he shot feet first and face down back into that medium upon which he had lived for more days and nights than he could remember and from which he himself had never completely emerged. As if his own failed and spent flesh were attempting to carry out his furious, unflagging will for severance at any price, even that of drowning, from the burden with which, unwitting and without choice, he had been doomed. Later it seemed to him that he had carried back beneath the surface with him the sound of the infant's first mewling cry.